Hey everybody, welcome to the show. You are listening to the Dom and Colin podcast. My name is Colin and I am here with Dom. Dom, how are you today?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. Now guys, coming up on today's show, we are going to be talking about episode 5 of Survivor Philippines. The return of reward challenges, lots going on. It's going to be good stuff. Before we get into that, however, I definitely want to let everyone know that we just recorded our latest retrospective. This time it is not with a survivor. It is with a Big Brother winner. It is Big Brother 14 winner Ian Terry. It should be up soon on iTunes. I don't think it's going to be up yet, but it should be coming very shortly. So definitely make sure you subscribe on iTunes to get all of our episodes. And definitely, you know, if you like the show, tell a friend. So Dom, I think if we're all set, let's get into what we're going to be talking about today, episode 5 of Survivor.
Yeah, I think very shortly is a bit optimistic, but that should be up sometime in the next week. We had a lot of fun doing it, and yeah, it's a lot more productive, I think, than maybe we expected it to be.
Oh, definitely. I mean, there was a ton of stuff that I think Ian totally answered all the questions we had quite well, and I am thrilled. You know, we actually talking to him post-game. He's interested in coming back on the show to talk some Survivor. He's also a big Survivor fan. So for people who maybe don't watch Big Brother but want to check this guy out because he may be back talking to us, I'd certainly recommend watching his season or just listening to him on the podcast. Yeah, so Dom, I think if we're good, let's get into episode 5. Now, what we saw last week is we finally lost Russell Swan. I shouldn't say finally so in such a demeaning way, but, you know, we ultimately ended up losing Russell Swan, inevitably lost Russell Swan, I guess I'll say. So now Matt Singh is down to just Malcolm and Denise, and that is where this episode begins, where they are now basically... before we get into this episode, let's talk about Russell Swan. This is something I definitely want to talk about. Russell Swan post-game, and sorry for kind of jumping the gun on the episode introduction. We'll talk about Malcolm and Denise very shortly, but Russell Swan post-game has had some interesting interviews. Do you have thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's weird, because usually, no matter who the contestant is, obviously there are a wide variety of personality types on the show. Usually in their post-game interviews, they're all pretty much the same. I mean, they might be critical of one person or another. They might have regrets about the way they played. But usually they follow the same kind of format, and the people who do them get to ask the same questions. And yeah, if you read one interview, you pretty much read all of them. It's just you change the names and you change some of the things they say. But with Russell Swan, his interviews were uniquely melancholy, I thought. They seemed almost like a kind of form of therapy for him. And you could tell that he was really taking this hard. And well, obviously he took it hard at the time, but I think watching it back on TV all these months later, it really reopened all of those wounds.
Yeah, totally. And he was definitely in a unique position amongst pretty much everyone who's returned in that he never really played a first time, I would posit at least. And thus, we didn't really know what to expect out of him this time. And I think his first time playing gave him a much better impression of Survivor in general and of himself than is perhaps accurate, and certainly this is not a great run for him on Survivor Philippines, and it could have gone much better, generally speaking, if he was given a second chance. Like, it's not always going to go this poorly for him, but certainly I think he saw some things about himself that he didn't really like on TV. I read his interview with Gordon Holmes, which I thought was really almost heartbreaking. I felt really bad for the guy, and I think Gordon did a great job kind of getting him to open up, first of all, if I can give some praise there, and people should definitely check it out. I got the kind of same impression that in basically all of his interviews, that was the same kind of idea, that he was really disappointed with himself.
Yeah, definitely. Because, like you said, the way he went on Samoa meant that he never had a chance to fail, if you want to be pessimistic about his chances. So when he was invited back for this season, he maybe didn't have the kind of awareness of his own failings in the game Survivor, if you like, that he would need in order to actually do well this time round. And looking at it from a different angle, I think he knew that he was kind of like the token third person that they brought back, along with two legends of the game in Scoopin' and Penner. Expectations are always going to be low for him, just in the Survivor fan community in general. And so not being able to challenge his expectations and just end where everything he does ends up confirming them, it has to be hard for him.
Yeah, I'm sure he was anticipating. You know, he's a pretty smart guy, I would assume, at least in general. He's an attorney. Where when he gets invited back, he's aware that some people are going to at least be saying, oh, what's this guy even doing coming back here? And I think he wanted to definitely prove people wrong, and I'm sure he did not prove many people wrong. I'm not sure how many people's expectations he really exceeded this season. I feel bad for the guy. I don't know. I just don't think there was much he could have. He's not built for this game, really.
Yeah, there seems to have been a lot of backlash against his interviews, actually, where people have been saying, well, this is self-pitying, you know, he has this very high opinion of himself, and what he's complaining about is that people don't agree with him rather than that he actually went through anything traumatic. And
I disagree with that.
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, that's what I'm engaging. This is the perception I've been getting, at least, that a lot of people just seem to think, well, it's been however long it's been now, 8 or 9 months, he should just get over it and move on. He's not a legend of the game. These things happen to, you know, 10 or 12 people every single season. Why is he the one who gets to be upset about it?
Right. It's like he just happened to be a returning player. And yeah, sorry for cutting you off. I knew you were just describing a perception. Yeah. I hadn't actually heard that, although I can certainly see where that's coming from. He did, and not to spend forever on Russell Swan, we'll definitely be getting to the new episode, but he definitely did come off quite arrogant on this season, talking about how he was a perfectly formed, one of God's perfectly formed creatures. And I think a lot of people might take issue with that statement, certainly given his result now, if people are taking that into consideration. And I don't know, what do we make about Russell Swan's, because I think his legacy is obviously destroyed, as in we're not going to see him play again or anything. So what do we think about as history closes the books on Russell Swan?
Yeah, he's obviously not doing himself any favors with some of the stuff he said on the show. But I think you can separate that from the attitude he's had in his post-game interviews, because I think people are kind of conflating the two a bit, where I think a lot of people are using the fact that he was, to be honest, kind of a joke on the show to conclude that, well, he doesn't have a right to be unhappy about anything that happened to him. And
yeah.
Do you agree with that at all?
Yeah, and this is kind of a point in the same line that I think he could have taken a lesson from. One thing I've noticed when watching many, many Survivor great players, and I'll include like Suri and Rob Cisternino here, but also someone like Sandra, is clearly there's going to be a joke going on. Be in on the joke. Like, act like you're in on the joke, and people will perceive you as being in on the joke instead of acting like, I feel like his big demonstration after Matt Singh lost that fourth challenge clearly showed to me what Malcolm stated earlier in last week's episode, which was that this guy lacks self-awareness. And I feel like if I were ever out there playing that I would go out with the mindset of there are going to be things that you might say in your real life that you just cannot say while you're out here. And you need to be constantly in this kind of mindset. And I just don't think he was. And I don't think he was anywhere close to the mindset you need to be in to be a successful Survivor player.
Yeah, definitely. But the impression I get is a lot of people think that in his interviews, even if he did feel genuinely heartbroken about the whole thing, that he should have just kept that under wraps and kept up appearances and just given the standard formulaic Survivor post-game interview.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of curious as to why more people don't seem more upset with themselves in post-game interviews.
Yeah, it's weird. See, the thing is, for Russell, he was clearly emotionally invested in being brought back to play the game Survivor again. And there was pretty much going to be no good outcome for him, because if you can't really say no if you want to do it that much, because for the rest of your life you're going to be thinking, well, what if I had gone back and given it another chance? So it's always going to say yes, and yet the same lack of skill that he displayed in Samoa were inevitably going to come back to bite him here at some point. So he wasn't going to do well enough to the point where he could actually get genuine resolution for himself about the whole thing. So it seemed like as soon as he was asked back to be on Survivor again, it was always going to end in failure for him, depending on how he defines failure, of course.
Right, yeah, no, I know what you mean. I think, well, I mean, given his definition of failure, he seems to take it really hard on himself, and maybe that's what all this is he does genuinely hold himself to these expectations that he said he held himself to on the show, which is failure is just not any kind of acceptable thing ever, and anything less than first place is failure.
Yeah, but it just strikes me as arrogant for a lot of fans to criticize him for acting like in a way that isn't commensurate with how they would have acted if they had gone through the same thing. Firstly, they have no idea how they would have reacted if they had gone through the same thing. And secondly, I think it's unfair to say that this is something that he should just get over, because part of it is going through this experience in the first place, and then another part of it is watching it on TV with all the publicity and stuff that comes along with that however many months later. And so this is something which is happening in the moment. It's fresh and it's raw, and it's something which he has to process in his own way, and I think it's not for other people to tell him how he should react to that. Because I could understand if he was doing what Russell Hantz, say, was doing, where he's just blasting all the other contestants and saying how he's the greatest and he should have won or whatever. Russell Swan hasn't been doing any of that. He hasn't been vocally critical of anyone. He's just been, you know, pretty downbeat about his own experience. But given that it's he's only been talking about himself, I don't see why it's anyone else's place to jump in on that.
Yeah, I kind of have two heads on, I guess, the end of this issue, or this whole issue itself, which is, on one hand, it's like, the guy didn't live up to his expectations by any means. I'm not going to look down on him for feeling bad about that himself. He certainly had, like, unrealistic expectations, I would say, but whatever, in his own mind, they were real. And I'm sure, like, how he reacts to failure, I'm not gonna be one to judge. And it's interesting that not many people seem to react like that. However, as a returning player who we've seen not do poor, granted he almost killed himself, but in his own mind, I think he thought of that as not losing. You know, he was never voted out or anything, and he was all smiles at the reunion in Samoa and everything, and was a generally positive guy, and I imagine was really cool in his post-game interviews, which is why people had him so high coming in. And what maybe got him a spot as a returning player in the first place is people liking him. And I'm guessing at this season's reunion, that's not going to be as much the case. And I don't like that it's because of his result that he's feeling so horrible about himself.
Yeah, for sure. So what more do we have to say about Russell? Because I think that despite the fact that he's only on the show for 4 episodes, I think bringing him back as a returning player proved to be a successful experiment.
Yeah, I like that they brought back a third person, I'll put it that way. And I think it's interesting to see what happens when a returning player doesn't just get the effects that we've seen returning players have just aren't there.
Yeah, for sure.
It's interesting to have seen that, and I'm glad. I think Survivor is better for having had that happen, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so I think that's enough about Russell Swan for now. Let's move on to the events of the actual episode. So where do we want to start with this? Because if we go through it chronologically, the first thing we see on the show is the aftermath of voting out Russell Swan. We see Malcolm and Denise back at camp the night of Tribal Council, and they are understandably despairing about their situation.
That's right. However, these two are some savvy players who know that we may not be at this beach much longer now that we're down to just the two of us. And so the next morning they end up trying to go out and look for the idol, which is some heads-up thinking, I would say, because they know Russell Swan never found it or he would have played it, so it's still got to be out there somewhere. One thing that's unclear to me is, did the producers tell them it's got to be somewhere, it's got to be something that's been here the whole time? Because it seems like that's the clue that many people have been going on.
Well, that was on the actual physical clue that people in the other tribes and Russell Swan managed to find, and yet we didn't see Malcolm and Denise find anything like that, and yet they were acting on... It seemed like the way they acted was reflective of their having found the clue. So maybe they just didn't show that in the episode or something for time's sake. I don't know.
Well, perhaps, I mean, it generally tends to be in a place that's nearby, at least something that has been there the whole time, or like in China when it was something that was on the camp itself that was there the whole time. So if there's certainly a historical precedent, which is if you're Malcolm and you're a super fan, you can certainly go on that, and it's why in previous shows I've said I would tear down all this camp ornamentation trying to find an idol. But I don't know. It seems like they would have been acting on that earlier, and story does not check out to me. It seems fishy, at least.
Yeah, they were assuming that there was some object or feature of the camp that had been there all along, which is what they would be thinking had they found the first clue. But I don't see why they were ruling out the possibility that it could just be stuck up some random tree somewhere. I mean, we see that a lot of times before, including recently.
Right, yeah, exactly. Right, yeah, okay. And maybe it's just the conspiracy theorist in both of us. Maybe they did find the clue and there was just no airtime. However, the next thing I actually want to talk about with this idol is what ends up happening is Malcolm gets it in his head as Denise is picking up the basket or whatever, and she's got the machete. He says, hey, let me see that for a second. And then after she puts it down, wanders over, just pops it off without saying a word. Did this seem deliberate to you on Malcolm's part? Or because he ends up getting sole possession of this idol, even though they're probably going to work in tandem.
Did what seem deliberate?
This effort to, instead of saying, oh, Denise, hey, maybe check and point that thing off, like, the thought went through his head, oh, this might be it, I'm going to get it, and then thus resulted in, hey, give me the machete.
Oh, yeah, obviously. This wasn't just idle curiosity. Once he saw that, something clicked, and he realized that that's what it had to be. And so he just trying to frame the question to Denise in a way that didn't come off as super suspicious.
Yeah, it seems like it's got to be always now in a place that will make you feel like an idiot for not having found it sooner.
Yeah, I think the editors realize they get a lot of mileage out of shots of people just wandering around the camp when it's 5 feet away from them. They're just completely oblivious to the fact that it's even there.
Yeah, with flashy graphics and everything, CBS spends big bucks for those. You got to work them in.
Yeah, and Malcolm committing the same mistake that Russell Swan did and saying, "I feel like an idiot." Never say that. Even if you do feel like an idiot, just don't. That they're going to exploit that in their own nefarious ways.
Any kind of context of, oh, this might make me look like an idiot or anything in that general wheelhouse is not where you want to be when you're giving confessionals. That's for sure. So let's move on now to this reward challenge. And it turns out that Malcolm and Denise are quite savvy players indeed, as they are given two buffs and told, which kind of, disheartening to me that they're going to be joining one to each of the already existing tribes. I was hoping, again, that they would switch it around to be 3-3-1, but not going to happen. However, this is not really a 50-50 draw, I would go so far to say. Malcolm and Denise in pulling a buff. I feel like both tribes have a pretty vested interest in pulling Malcolm here.
Sure, just for physical strength.
Right, yeah. It seems like they're probably going to only be in these new tribes for a round or two, and neither tribe, given these shakeups, might be that thrilled about going to tribal council, so they're probably going to be trying in challenges, and it's always nice to at least get to the merge with immunity.
Sure, although, again, I think it's a mistake to think of tribes as units, because, for instance, I agree that Calibor in general would be better served by having Malcolm, but the women of Calibor would be better served by having Denise.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, I think for Arcee and Scoopin, it might have been better to have Denise on their team instead of Malcolm. Although, again, Tandang's interests as a group are better served by having Malcolm just for the challenges.
Well, how do we know that if Malcolm doesn't draw that red buff, because, what we end up seeing is Malcolm goes to Tandang, but if Malcolm draws red, how do we know he doesn't hit it off with Katie right away and he forms an unbreakable alliance with the girls, they feel solid, and Dana doesn't quit? Spoiler alert.
That's certainly possible, but the point is, it's not just as simple as saying, well, Malcolm's strong, we want Malcolm.
No, I agree. Okay. I concur. But this reminds me of, like, Coach and Ozzy, where Ozzy, everyone's sitting there silently rooting for Ozzy, but there's still some upside to getting Coach.
Okay. For some people in particular, it's better to get the person who isn't the consensus pick for who people would want on their tribe. So, for instance, to use that example, in South Pacific, I think someone like Cochran would be far better served by having Coach on his tribe than he would by having Ozzy. But again, like for the group in general, just numerically, it's far better to have Ozzy, and even for Cochran though, because if you have Ozzy, it's far less likely that you're in a position where that choice between Ozzy and Coach becomes relevant in terms of voting or whatever.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good example. So let's talk about this reward challenge, because what we end up seeing here is this is one of our ones that we like, where the players outthink the challenge. And it's actually Mike Scoopin, the silent Mike Scoopin here, once again not getting confessional time, but or at least that, not that I'm remembering, but outthinking the challenge quite nicely. The way it works is they each were holding little idols up on these on little podiums, basically, and you're trying to knock the other person's idol off of their holder. And so Mike would just throw his idol up into the air and then run over and slam off, like, for instance, Jeff Kent's idol and slam it to the ground while his was still way high up in the air. And that counts as a win, even though he let go of his idol first. So that's very savvy stuff. Any extra thoughts on that?
Yeah, I was kind of kicking myself for not realizing that was possible earlier. And I think it's, again, it's very smart on Scoopin's part that he realized that. But it seems like it's something which only works for the first few times you try it, because now, if you try it on someone, then they have a perfect counter strategy. They can just do exactly the same thing you did and throw their idol up in the air. Now, you're just going to hit the ground first and you're out. So,
right.
If this becomes an established strategy, then the best thing to do is just fight fair, or fair in quotation marks, and just play the challenge normally. But I think it's obviously going to work the first time, because people just aren't going to notice what's going on until you successfully do it to them. And it might even work if the person on the other team that your player is going up against is someone who isn't able to think on the fly like that, so someone like Abby or whoever. If Abby were in the challenge, which, I mean, she was this time, but that was an anomaly.
That's right. No, this was very cool, I thought, on Scoopin's part. It's kind of like, as Dom mentioned, it becomes a point where there's a perfect defense for it, where as soon as they throw theirs up, you throw yours up, so there's a hit first. However, then there becomes like third-level thinking, which we saw later, where Carter and Pete are trying to, like, pump fake each other into throwing their idol unprompted, basically. It was very cool stuff. And it ultimately, like, if there are game bots playing this, it resolves back, like Dom said, to them just playing straight up in the first place, because there becomes no incentive either way to start messing around with your own idol.
Yeah, clearly the challenge just doesn't work as a television event if people just throwing their idols up in the air and hoping that the other person hits the ground first. But I think the producers realised that if everyone realises what's going on, then they are going to start adapting to it by reacting that way, and so people aren't going to do that in the first place. And it works nicely as a challenge if people fight fair for most of the rounds, but someone who is thinking on their feet is able to execute that one time and do some flashy move or whatever.
Yeah, and it's not even something that you necessarily have to then say, oh no, you can't do that anymore. Like, for instance, a guy I know is a professional game inventor. This is true. And he has myself and some of my groups of friends like play out his games to like practice them and see if we can like find flaws in games he's in the process of designing. And basically the way the rules process works is we set up rules that are established until one person becomes too good at something and finds some way to angle it, and then the rules are adjusted. And in Survivor, you can't really change the rules mid-challenge, and I like that, that there was still the possibility of doing it, but everyone still kind of, so everyone was basically the threat of throwing the idol up became more powerful than actually throwing the idol up.
Right.
Yeah. So, great story. All right. So what we end up seeing happen here is Tandang wins, shockingly.
Well, actually, hold on.
Go ahead.
Before we get onto that, I just wanted to remind everyone of Artis's excellent slapping technique.
Actually, I wanted to mention this. How is that fair that Artis gets to go against Dana? It seems like this should be a guys against girls thing, because it seems like long arms are going to have a major advantage.
Well, Tandang has four guys at this point to Calibur 3, so would you just have Calibur put someone in for a second round then, or what?
Just whatever order you're going in, people repeat as necessary, as unoften as possible.
Okay, yeah, that might work.
Yeah.
Although I'm glad that happened, because it gave us this great moment from Artis. First, on the collection of great Artis moments, is right up there, I think.
Yeah, I just did the no one listening could see it, but I just did this little slapping motion. Artis is slowly racking up the winner highlight reel.
Yeah. It's weird, because I really like Artis, but I like him because we get to see so little of him. Like, I think if we saw a lot of him, he'd just be some normal guy who isn't particularly interesting. But the fact that he's almost invisible is what draws people's attention to him in some kind of perverse way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Like, every Artis scene seems so carefully crafted because they don't want to oversaturate us with Artis.
Yeah, and another moment from the challenge is Abby continuing to build her persona and calling Dawson a bitch, which, I mean, you've got to step up here and defend your girl Dawson.
Yeah, okay. I guess it's worth getting out of the way now. We all know how this episode ends. Dawson gets voted out. For those of you who did not listen to the preview podcast, Dawson was my expert winner pick. And now I'm going to have this is going to be something that we talk about for sure as this breakdown continues, but this was a very well edited episode, kind of like not to the same degree, nor was it intended to be to the same degree as episode four. But I was convinced Katie was gone this whole time, and after all of this, I guess it was more after the immunity challenge we start hearing more from Katie. But I thought Abby calling Dawson a bitch was nothing more than just highlighting what a bitch Abby is, rather than showing us more Dawson as she's on her way out.
Well, yeah, if we want to get on to Katie quickly, I think it's understandable that you'd think that way, because the time-honored technique for the editors is to give the person who's previously been invisible for the past four episodes a lot more airtime in the episode where they happen to go home. And so when you get this Katie confessional 10 minutes in that just doesn't concern anything at all, just her rambling, then you think, well, why did they include it unless they want to get something out of her before she goes? But the moment which made me question that was when Dawson was talking about leading Jeff Kent along, like she's a cat and he's a mouse or whatever. And I thought that was expert irony if they wanted to go that route.
That's very true. That was after the immunity challenge, wasn't it? One thing I did want to say is last season, actually, during the Jay episode where he got voted out, I remember Leaf got some confessionals for the first time, and subsequently the Jay boot kind of surprised me, because I was sitting there saying, oh, I'm finally hearing from Leaf. Good night, nurse, to Leaf. That's game over. And it was the same kind of technique here. So bravo to the editors who are apparently now on level two.
Yeah, although the fact that it's taken them 25 seasons to get there is kind of disappointing. Like, you would just hope that they would have enough faith in the audience, and you would hope that faith would be rewarded by said audience, that they wouldn't have to Like, they wouldn't be able to just coast along doing the same thing over and over for, what, like, hundreds and hundreds of episodes.
They are following the number one rule of escaping. Develop a pattern, deviate from that pattern, and we will never catch on to them. So, there we go. All right, so where do we want to go? Let's talk about Malcolm now over at Tandang, because it's pretty... basically what we see, of course we're going to get kind of establishing shots from each of the new tribes talking about their new player, and at Tandang it's everybody's loving Malcolm, and there's a lot happens here. So what are you thinking about, let's talk about what do you think about Malcolm just being on Tandang now that he and Denise are split up?
Well, he's in a great position, and I think he realizes that. Like, when you're on a tribe that hadn't had to go to tribal yet, then you know that there are going to be fault lines in there that you can work your way into and exploit. And, yeah, and Malcolm seems to be in the process of doing this already. And he doesn't even have to do anything actively because people are coming to him and trying to enlist him to go against other people in their tribe. So, yeah, he's sitting pretty right now. And there were a lot of secret scenes this week in which pretty much everyone was talking about how they just love having Malcolm in their tribe. Like, Pete was saying he clicks with Malcolm really well because, you know, they're the same age and everything. Lisa's saying he's a great kid, he brings a lot of positive energy and he's great in challenges. Arthur's saying he likes Malcolm. Scoopin didn't have a scene praising Malcolm because why would he have a scene? I mean, that is a preposterous idea. Although, what I liked actually is he did have what they call a deleted scene where everyone else had a secret scene implying they had something in addition to what they already had. Whereas Scoopin, like, he was in the show and then they cut him out because they just didn't want him in there for some reason. But he wasn't as effusive in his praise of Malcolm as the others, but he doesn't seem to have a problem with him, which is all that he needs at this point. And again, Abby is not the type to praise people, I don't think, but she didn't seem offended by Malcolm at all either. And RC, I think, realizes that Malcolm's a savvy player, but she's desperate at this point, so she needs his vote to do anything, so she can't be going after him. So, yeah, I don't think there's anybody in the Tandang tribe right now that wants Malcolm out of the game, and that's how it should be, and he can enjoy that.
Yeah, I think Malcolm and RC might be kind of like a breath of fresh air for each other. Although, you're right that we do see this relationship developing with Pete, but RC just strikes me as wildly more sane than Pete and Abby, and easier to relate to than Scoop and Artis and Lisa. It's interesting seeing Malcolm getting pulled from, like, all the different directions and everything, and what we ultimately end up seeing is Pete really wants to swing Malcolm, as it appears at least, because Pete just comes right out and says, oh, and by the way, if you come with us, we've got the idol. And I feel like that's some information you should be keeping until he says, oh, by the way, I'm with you guys for sure. If even then.
Yeah, it's a very bold play by Pete, although I think I like it more than you do, maybe, because I feel like if you volunteer that information without trying to put feelers out first, then it shows you're willing to put trust in people. And I think Pete, if he were more aware of his image, might realize that if he's perceived as dumb by just giving that away to Malcolm right off the bat, then Malcolm is going to be less inclined to go against Pete because now Malcolm is going to think that this is someone he can use for his own devices later.
I think he has to be giving Malcolm a lot of credit to be doing that within 20 minutes, which I think Malcolm honestly deserves that kind of credit, but I don't think Pete can know that.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that Malcolm did not seek this kind of deal with Pete, although we don't dock him points for that because part of playing ultimately in a situation like this is just sitting back and having a persona which makes you the kind of person that other people want to confide in, and Malcolm's doing that very well.
Much like Kim Spradlin last year, I would say, where everyone just wants to talk to her and tell her everything and be in an alliance with her and never vote her out.
Yeah, I think the temptation, if you're put on a new tribe suddenly, is to just panic and start scrambling as hard as you can, but Malcolm is, if the secret scenes are any indication, is not doing that. He's just being very chilled, laying back, and letting the game come to him, in Scoopin's words. And I think that's a great thing to do, because Pete and Malcolm are operating in exactly the opposite ways from how I think we expected them to, where Pete is now the hyper-aggressive game player who's making all these risky moves, and Malcolm's just sitting back and thinking about the game in a very kind of mature, self-aware fashion.
Yeah, I don't think anyone really had Pete for being the guy to sit and think about the game in a mature... No, I know what you're saying, though. But it does certainly seem like a lot of people were really jumping to assign Malcolm the role that Pete seems to have fallen into, which I was never really on board with that. I still feel like Malcolm is exactly the same guy that he was in the pregame things.
Right, yeah, and I think a good signal of how secure Malcolm feels is going to be if he plays his idol at the first tribal council that Tandang goes to, if they do go to one. Now, you can argue that even if he does feel that like he doesn't have something good going there, he might not want to play it anyway, because the idol is a gun with one bullet. Like, if everyone else is determined to get you out, then it's not going to save you ultimately unless you go on some prodigious immunity streak. You can argue that maybe that's different when the merge is about to come or whatever, but in general, like, if the idol is not a tool that you can just use to vault to the end of the game and a catapult to the win, it's something which you can use if you're in a kind of average position or good position to further entrench yourself. It's not something which can bring you out of a bad position most of the time.
Most of the time, unless you do something really dynamic and then make some crazy stuff happen, and that's really the only time I can think of that is like Russell Hands.
Right, although you can question how all that worked out for him. Like, who's got the chip?
Well, no, but I think someone with a better social game in Russell Hands' position, and this is something I want to talk about actually, is Malcolm's social game is something that is blowing me away, and I want to really hit on what I mean by that, which is this is something that there was some discussion about on the forum that we talk about Survivor on, and I really like the definition that was kind of come up with, which is, rough, and I'm paraphrasing here, but I think social game really has two kind of key components. One, the first being like having traits and treatment of people such that they want to be in an actively like tell you things and not vote you out. And part two, having traits and treatment of people such that they want to vote for you at the end after you have voted them out. And I think Malcolm is absolutely crushing it on all cylinders there, much like, again, like Kim did last season.
Yeah, for sure. And we saw him be understandably very pleased that he found the idol, but I think one of the marks of a great player is that they don't need to use the idol most of the time. Like, if you think back to all the people who have used it successfully or unsuccessfully, I think the only person we would classify as a great player who needs to end up using it was, I think, Yao Man. But beyond that, I mean, people have played it just for security's sake. Like, there's no reason not to play it if it's going to expire. But I think he's the only one who needed to be saved by it who we want to speak about in those terms.
Right, yeah. Did Steven ever even end up... Did he just sit on his forever?
Yeah, he never needed to use it.
No, I know he never needed to, but like Chase and Sash both just played them out of might as well at Final Six.
Right, but that's...
Like Sandra, yeah.
Yeah, again, that's not really significant or anything there.
No. Yeah, but no, it just kind of crossed my mind that a lot of the time the person who gets the idol is it used to be the people who were getting sent to Exile Island, basically, because that's where it always was. So it was usually alpha males, and now that's kind of it's switched up a little bit.
Yeah, whenever gaining the idol is linked to some kind of twist, then you can like cast type the type of people who are going to get the idol in terms of who you think is going to be a victim of that twist, or the beneficiary, I guess, if the idol's there. And so, like you say, in Exile Island's case, if you're going to be sending alpha males there all the time, then alpha male is going to end up with the idol. And I think that's an often overlooked flaw of people's thinking in those seasons, where if you know that the idol's there, just don't send an alpha male. Send someone who... Because I get the logic, like you want to weaken them for future challenges and stuff, but thinking long term, don't you just want to send someone who, on the basis of the information you have, is on the bottom of the other tribe so that they can maybe mix things up a bit?
Yeah, oh, definitely. You certainly do. You always want to, if you can influence the other tribe, you want to give the people on the bottom something to do.
Yeah, I guess a good example of the point I'm making about the idol is, Abby Maria finding it is not going to change her future in the game much. Like, it may change the way in which things play out for her, but if she's going to lose a jury vote because no one likes her, then the idol isn't going to change that. And if everyone wants it gone and the idol is able to save her for one round, then great, but she's going to be gone in 3 or 6 days anyway.
But, I mean, do we think Ave Maria is really going to be the type who's getting... Because it seems to me like, while her position should be terrible, it seems kind of... I guess we can be talking more about this later as we talk about things moving forward. But Ave Maria at least seems like not necessarily such a lock to go anytime soon in my mind.
I think this comes back to how you're defining a good position, because she is set up very well to make it deep in the game and probably go to the finals. But part of the reason for that is that everyone is going to want to take her there. Like, no one has a reason to vote her out because they know they can beat her.
No, I'm not trying to make a case now that I think Ave Maria can win, and I agree that she's probably as close to drawing dead in on island real time as anyone was, at least to the point that we are now. I feel like a lot of people are thinking, oh, she's, for the people who are, and you may not be among these people, for the people who are thinking, oh, why, everyone's going to hate her, she's going to go soon, I'm thinking that's not going to be the case. And that's, of course, I think you understand why. for because post merge things change.
Right, I think we've seen, particularly in recent seasons, that assuming that people don't like this person, therefore they're going to get voted out soon is very simplistic thinking that doesn't get borne out in reality very often.
Right, yeah, okay. Well, one thing I want to actually ask about, one thing that we see highlighted before we move on to Denise over at Calabar, is RC now at the Tandang tribe. What the hell? Why can't she make a friend here?
Yeah, this is weird. And comparing the whole experience to bullying, I thought was kind of disingenuous. I mean, again, far be it for me to question the experiences she's gone through in her life, but this, I don't know, it doesn't seem particularly analogous.
What did you think of her idea, at least that we saw as it portrayed on TV, to like flirt her way in with Malcolm?
I know Gary reacted to this very violently, saying that he thought this is indicative that RC is just a terrible player, but I'm not so sure about that, because from her perspective, she's tried being herself to all of these people, and it hasn't worked. And now, Malcolm has been added to their tribe, and he seems to be clicking with all of these people who have shunned her. And so she might be thinking, well, if he's like these other people, then I need to try some new approach to get him on my side, and flirting is the most obvious candidate there. So I can understand what she's doing, but whether or not it's likely to work is a different question.
I can assure you it would be likely to work on me.
nobody doubts that.
Yeah, I would be all over this. This would be a winning strategy for RC. And I honestly, dude, I just feel like Malcolm and RC are on a different, like, plane than the rest of the younger, than I guess just Pete and Abby, where I just don't know how Malcolm's going to, at the end of the day, really hitch his wagon there, unless he wants it to be like a super long-term thing where Denise is no longer in his mind, which might be the case.
Oh, so you think his logic is, well, these people are far more competitive on a strategic level than people like Pete and Abby, so there's no reason for me to team up with RC and Scoopin' when they might be tougher competition down the road?
I'm just thinking more along the lines of his logic may not be who do I like the most.
Oh, sure. Like, I don't think Malcolm is the type to make decisions on such an emotional basis.
Mm.
Although,
yeah, I think
and for Malcolm, like, he is someone who could do that if he wanted, because it seems like everyone does genuinely like him. So if he wanted to make a decision using that as his criterion, then he could do that, and he could have his pick of whoever he wanted.
Yeah, totally. Like, go ahead.
Yeah, it's not like he's in a situation where he likes somebody and wants to work with them, but they just refuse to work with him for some reason. Like, and that's not just because he's a swing vote, which obviously he is, but it's because, as we've touched on many times, people like the guy.
Yeah. There's really no other way to put it. It's kind of, it's like Dan on Big Brother. People just at the end of the day just go, I like this guy, except when they're voting. So,
and again, it's 5 episodes in, so it's hard to make any definitive conclusions. But again, we love everything we've seen of Malcolm so far, and there's no reason to question his judgment yet.
Exactly. So let's talk now about the new Calabar tribe with Denise. What do we think about just Denise ending up on Calabar? First thoughts?
Well, it's more difficult to evaluate Denise's position, I think. Although, in some ways it's easier, because now she's on a tribe where there are clear dividing lines, so you have the guys on one side and the girls on the other, and she's the seventh vote, so whatever she wants to do, she can do, basically, and the others are pretty much forced to go along with it. But then her hand gets forced by Dana being medevac, so now the best she can do, even if she were able to keep Katie and Dawson in check, would be to force a tie and then go to rocks, which I can imagine if you've been suffering out there for, 12 days so far, you don't want to just have all that go to nothing just because you draw Purple Rock to defend Katie or Dawson. It's just, I can understand her decision there.
Totally. I think she would have gone with the guys anyway. I think Denise gets along quite well with guys.
Yeah, I think on its own terms, just siding with Panda and Jeff Gant and Carter is the right decision anyway.
I mean, honestly, and this is not trying to sound weird or whatever, if you're going to be a sex therapist and be good at it, you've got to have a very strong understanding of, like, how men think, especially if you're a woman. I'm not joking.
Yeah, that's a perfectly fine point. Like, you don't get as far in life in her profession as she does without a strong understanding of male psychology.
Right. Yeah. So, and this is the point, actually, where we start hearing a ton from Katie, which, again, for me was, oh, my God, now Katie's going to go, and I'm going to have to sit and watch another half hour here of this boring, predictable episode. Calabar's going to lose, and it's going to be, Dawson's just going to keep right on trucking through.
Yeah, well, you said you thought it would be a boring, predictable episode, and I imagine part of that was hyperbole, but Do you think it actually was? Because, I mean, I think it was a downgrade over last episode, but almost anything would have been.
I think it was because I was so invested in, I was so caught up in the idea of Katie going that there was, I didn't even consider, because of the way they timed the Dawson, quote, decoy edit, where I thought it was just the standard final segment before we had to tribal council, here's who might get voted out but is in no way ever going to get voted out part.
Yeah, and also, as we said last week, they had so much to cram into this episode, and my theory that there wouldn't be a medevac or a swap or anything like that was based on the assumption that if they need to cram everything in, yeah, good call by me, of course, obviously. If they need to cram all of this stuff in, then they're not going to have time to develop any of that. And I think that's what we saw happen, where they had the swap, and then they had to deal with Malcolm and Denise fitting into their new tribes, and then the medevac and two challenges, which I thought there would just be a combined challenge for this one, but they managed to fit two challenges in, and then pre-tribal council scrambling, and then tribal council. And the result of that was they didn't really have time to flesh out any of those storylines very far. And that's not a criticism of the editors, because they couldn't really have played it any other way, but it's just a natural consequence of how of the events that happened during those 3 days.
Yeah, after last week's 5-minute long debate about the time they would have to cram in how many segments into what and who was getting swapped and whether or not there would be a medevac, I felt like kind of a dick. After watching this episode, I felt like it was all justified.
That's my one criticism of the editors. They gave you ammunition. It was validating every stupid thing you ever thought.
I don't have a crystal ball. I have a crystal brain. It is one of the greatest quotes I've ever heard in my life, and I try to live by that every day. Let's talk about the medevac, if you're so inclined.
All right.
So what we end up seeing here, well, we can call this a medevac, or we can call this a quit. I guess that's the big debate, because what ends up happening is Dana ends up starting to not feel too great pretty spur of the moment. She seemed like she was all right, you know, getting owned by artists in the challenge and then getting to know Denise and everything. Long story short, medical comes in. And they'd say, you know, we're not going to pull you unless your life is in danger. And the doctor, who is not Dr. Ramona, for the first time, I think, ever, says, yeah, your life's not in danger. You could keep going. And I'm sure, I don't want to make light of the situation, but because I'm sure she was in pain. But it was at least not something that they were going to pull her over. However, Dana says, I've had enough. I'm out of here anyway. Dom, what do we think about this?
Well, what they said was, your situation isn't critical yet, and we're going to come back in 12 hours. And given the way that Dana apparently just fell apart, it's apparent that if they had come back in 12 hours, then it might well have been the point where she did have to be taken out. And I think that masks a lot of people, that kind of disguises the fact that she was in genuine pain. And so when people say, oh, she quit, well, if medical had come back in 12 hours and taken her out, you wouldn't be saying that. So why should she suffer through 12 hours of intense pain without any of life's comforts just to appease you as a viewer?
No, and she should not. However, when getting technical about things, was she medevaced? Did they medically evacuate her?
If you want to get technical, no, they didn't. But that's not the point here.
No, and I agree, in spirit, this is a medevac. If we're getting technical, it's a quit. However, I think the big reason she quit was because she said, okay, well, the likelihood I'm going to leave in just 12 hours from now is super, super high, and I would rather go get fixed now than later. Which is totally fine with me.
Right, and given her condition, I think it's likely that had she stayed, she would have been gone as soon as Calibor lost a challenge anyway.
Oh, yeah.
It's not like the course of the game for Calibor was materially affected, other than the fact that now they're down one person before they even go into the challenge.
Well, actually, that's kind of a point of contention. I think, one, Boston Rob would disagree that she would be gone if Calibor lost a challenge. We'll be talking more about that later, I guess, but... Well, we can talk about the pros and cons of, I guess, keeping Denise down the line. But I think given the actual Calibor dynamics, given that Boston Rob's not on that tribe, I think she would have been the one to go had they still gone on to lose that challenge, for sure.
Okay. You don't think Denise would have sided with the women?
No. I think she was going with the guys. I think she would, and to put it, to kind of step on one of my later points, I think she's smart to have been siding with the guys.
Well, in particular, I think the guys were smart to approach her, and specifically Jeff Kent, who, again, it's hard to think of him as some kind of great player, but so far he seems to be playing his hand pretty well.
I don't think it's that hard to think of him as a great Survivor player at this point, honestly. It's hard to compartmentalize. Well, yeah, I know what you mean.
We've never seen him have to put his money where his mouth is yet. So I think it's very conceivable that he just spazzes out and does something stupid.
I think he is crushing it from all conceivable angles, and he is one for one on getting the perfect vote out. Again, stepping on all my future points, but that's okay.
Let's see how he handles it if, say, their down numbers coming into a merge, or if, like, let's say they're a swap. How would he handle things being shaken up in a way which he couldn't predict? Like, there are so many contingencies which he hasn't had to deal with yet that I think it's very hazy to label him as some potentially great survivor player. Although, again, no mistakes thus far that we can fault him for.
Yeah, actually, let's save most of the Jeff Kent discussion for later, after when we talk about the merits of booting Dawson.
Okay.
Let's talk, quick Dawson thing. There was some phenomenal foreshadowing that I noticed when watching back this episode, where after Dawson, when Jeff Probst comes into their camp to check on Dana, she's like, oh, I wanted to jump up and down and give him a hug, but it just wasn't the right timing. And I was like, oh, that's cute, Dawson. You know, maybe you'll get your chance to do that when you're collecting your $1 million winner check after you just won, which I completely predicted. Little did we know, she would get her chance to hug Probst later.
Yeah, I didn't know that irony at the time because I was too focused on the fact that you just lost your winner pick. But now that you mention it, I mean, that's great. Nice observation.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, I mean, I was trying to savor every last frame I could get. Okay, so Dana's gone. However, still going to be playing for immunity here, which clues me in, Dom, that we're not going to be merging at 12. More on that to come later. However, refreshing change of pace here right off the bat for this immunity challenge. Ava Marie is going to sit out. What do we think about this? She's now played 2, which is, two is a lot.
And she was so forthright with it when Jeff asked her. Was like, Ava Marie, how many challenges have you played? 2? As if, were you expecting anything different?
Yeah, it's like, why do you ask? Is it weird? This is what I don't understand. I know, I believe, I'm not positive, but I think this rule was first changed. I think like Courtney from Heroes vs. Villains was the first one to exercise this rule that you can sit out challenges as long as they don't conflict. You can sit out back-to-back as long as they are between 2 episodes, which I think is a stupid rule.
Well, I think it made sense as a rule when they had a reward challenge and an immunity challenge in every single episode cycle, but now that they don't, yeah, it just allows people to sit out continuously, which is obviously not what they intended when they came up with these rules to begin with.
Right, no, I like the rule in the first place. But I think it should just be, regardless of how the episodes break down, you can't sit out back-to-back. And again, Amrita didn't sit out back-to-back, but she sat out of, like, because she did play the reward challenge where she got stomped. But she has sat out of, what is it, all but 2? So what, 7? She sat out of 5 challenges or something?
Yeah.
Or maybe 3 or 4?
I mean, I don't mind the rule because it places less emphasis on challenge strength. Like, if you have someone who's weak, you can just sit them out as often as you want without really affecting your overall performance that much. But given that their intent was to limit the amount of challenges people sit out, then, yeah, they just failed completely on that regard.
Right, yeah, it's like swing and a miss at the one thing you're trying to regulate.
Yeah, like I don't agree with regulating it in that way, but if you do, then do it properly.
Right, and Jeff acts all disgusted, like, Ava Marie is sitting out. And again, like, you could change this rule yourself, Jeff. He has that kind of sway.
Yeah, Jeff's jimmies were severely rustled this episode. Firstly by Katie in the... No, firstly by Ava Marie in the Raw Challenge, and then by Katie as well. It's like, she's up over the platform, like, 3 seconds after everyone else. Like, Katie, just dragging her tribe to failure. Like, come on, Jeff.
I felt bad for her. Like, if I'm in that situation, it's like, relax, dick. I'm trying. Like, get off me. I'm in last place. Start talking about what's happening up there.
Yeah, it seems like people do this a lot. Like, in South Pacific, where Cochran takes half a second to climb on someone's back to get over the wall. It's like, Cochran, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, he's like, Cochran, slowing Savai down substantially. Losing a lot, literally seconds on that wall climb. Like, it wasn't even, like, he asked the tribal council, was that a noticeable thing? Yeah, well, as mentioned, this was not a great challenge for Katie, and this was, once again, I go, okay, well, here's now that I'm getting the, oh, here's who Katie is, and now here's why Katie's going to get voted out in 5 minutes, and I'm getting the second piece of that puzzle, and Katie's going to go because she can't do the challenges, and Dawson's going to be fine, and that's where I'm at again as I'm watching this episode for the first time.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it was clear that element of suspense was taken out of the episode. Like, none of the guys were going to go here, given how the first half an hour of the episode played out. But so it's clear Denise was going to side with them if it came to it. But the only question that remained was which of Katie and Dawson, or I guess Dana, if she'd still been there, would have gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I kept, yeah, it seemed like Denise, they never even, of course, never tried to even paint as the boot. They painted her as hitting it off immediately with people, which I think generally speaks very well for both Denise and Malcolm. They painted both of them quite positively.
Yeah, definitely. And I think if you're going to look at the editing, then those two are near the top of your winner's rankings at this point.
They are not near the top of the winner rankings. They are the top of the power rankings, yeah.
All right, that's fair. I think there's room for movement there, but yeah, they're definitely in that upper tier at least.
Yeah, and it's a combination of both edit, I like what I'm seeing from them as people, and it's the combination of those two. And also, of course, their position in the game.
Yeah, definitely.
Because they're both in, once again, just phenomenal positions, I would say, within their new tribes. So, what ends up happening in this immunity challenge is Caliball loses. This was a hardcore immunity challenge, by the way. There were, like, four phases. You have to run through water and then over dirt and then, like, untie stuff and go through a gate and chop wood and then do a puzzle. These are some hardcore challenges compared to the old ones.
Well, recently the challenges have been kind of weak. So I'm glad that we have something which is more like a traditional Survivor challenge. One thing I thought was weird, though, was at the stage where they had to put people on their shoulders so they could go and untie the clips holding the door in place, why weren't the people on the bottom untying them at the same time?
I didn't know. Yeah.
Oh, because maybe I just missed something watching the episode or it wasn't portrayed accurately or something, but it seemed like, for instance, Scoopy was standing there and RC was on his shoulders untying the thing. And then Scoopy was just standing there, and then as soon as she got off, then he started going to work on the thing. And you think, well, couldn't you just speed the whole challenge up by doing that at the same time?
Well, I think there might be concern that she would fall off if she was not being held onto.
Yeah, but what?
Like he's got to occupy his hands somehow.
Weren't the other members of the tribe just standing there not doing anything though?
I think they can only maybe you can only have two people untying at a time or something.
Okay, I think maybe you could have one person there, like, holding the top person up or something, I don't know.
Anyway. I don't know, it seems like they would have been doing it, you're right, yeah, you know, huge oversight, once again, if they could have been doing it and weren't.
Yeah, probably a completely irrelevant point, but just putting that out there.
Yeah, that's fine. So anything else about the challenge before we move on?
No, that's fine.
Okay, yeah, so let's go back to Caliball Camp, because they are the challenge losers by, they actually had a hell of a comeback, and Penner almost banged off that puzzle. But they did not live, well, one of them was not going to live to play another day, as this is now the sweat for who's going to be voted out. And again, I'm sitting there going, all right, it's Katie, let's just get through this. But not the case, because we start getting to see Dawson might be on the hot seat, and Dawson playing her own little cat and mouse game with Jeff Kent, unaware of which one she is in this position, starts really trolling him pretty hard about being a baseball player. And this is some very good stuff on Dawson's part. Like, I appreciate the wit that went into this. I also think it kind of should be you might better know your place in the tribe.
Yeah, that was brilliant. This is what I think initially attracted everyone to Dawson, this facet of her personality. Because with Katie, it's just she's just there, she's kind of boring, doesn't really have anything to say. But with Dawson, at least, you know that she's going to be mixing things up somehow, even if it's in a relatively minor way.
Yeah, and I actually ended up thinking that this played a much bigger role in why she got voted out than it did. And part of that was because some speculation was that perhaps she and Jeff Kent kind of knew that she knew who he was, which I could see. I think Jeff Kent, I don't know which seasons he's seen or whatever, but if he's familiar whatsoever with Survivor Guatemala, he can probably do the math. They're going to put someone on my tribe who knows me. And if he can get that one person out, like the Danny Boatwright to his Gary Hogaboom or Hogaboom, however you say it, that's going to mean good things for him, especially if he can make that happen pre-jury.
I don't think that was helped by the fact that I think Dawson comes across as very wolfy, if you want to use that phrase, where it's very easy to think that she has some kind of subtext whenever she's talking to you. And even if you're not suspicious of her, the fact that she seems suspicious of you is going to make you suspicious of her, if that makes sense.
Right, yeah. She always seems like she has some kind of ulterior motive. And I think I would definitely think – I was disappointed, first of all, that she didn't cast her one vote for Jeff Kent, although I guess that she thought it was between Katie and Denise because she voted for Denise and she was clearly blindsided, so she didn't think it was going to be her.
Yeah, one question I had was why didn't she just blow up Jeff Kent's spot as soon as she was voted out?
I think she probably thought that would be bad form.
Maybe. Yeah, like it –
I think it is.
I can see that.
I really think it is.
It would look kind of bad.
I think do it while you're in the game or don't do it.
Yeah, I also think that it would be kind of questionable within the rules to do that. Like, if you're going to reveal information of any kind, then you do it before you're formally voted out of the game. And that if you're able to just do anything you want in that gap between you getting voted out and you getting your torch off, then that's a flaw in the rules.
Yeah, it seems kind of ambiguous because, it just seems like more people would turn around as soon as they see the deciding vote come up and just start blowing up everyone's spot that they hate all the time. It seems like they would cast enough types that would do that if they could.
Yeah, I'm surprised we don't see more people do something like Mike Boogie's Ian, where it's like, this guy's a rat, you need to not trust him or whatever. Or even something like, if you want to go to the next level, you do what Troy sent it to Cap, but with obviously different intentions, where you kind of hug them or whatever on your way out and make it look like you and the rest of the jury are putting for them to win, when in fact you just... So you give other people incentive to get that person voted out, like if you don't want them to get the 100K or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a different level than most people are going to be on right after they've been voted out in Survivor. But yeah, no, it's a good idea.
Yeah, but if you think back to what Sophie said, where she said she and Coach were seriously considering taking Ozzy to the end, but then they saw the jury's reaction when he started winning immunities and they just realized that was a no-go. Like, how stupid do you have to be if you're on that jury and to not just mask your intentions as much as you can?
It seems crazy. That always struck me as well. I still don't know. I guess if they said they were considering it, then I'm sure they were. I don't know that at the end of the day they pulled the trigger on taking Ozzy with so many Savaii there, but yeah, that's certainly... I think the Savaii jury was probably doing the math. Well, they picked all of us off. Ozzy's gonna have to win his way there.
Yeah, and maybe they just wanted to outwardly show their support for him, which you can understand. Right. Like, it's normal human reaction, but yeah, it's something to think about at least.
Yeah. So what ends up happening is Dawson gets voted out 5-1. Again, her vote goes towards Denise. And actually, one thing worth hitting on is she is, I believe, the first person ever, and again, I'm not positive about this. She, on her way out, gives Jeff Probst a hug and a kiss goodbye. I'm not happy that my winner pick is gone. I'm glad that she made kind of that last... I'm sure she's made a lasting impression on Jeff Probst. And certainly on... maybe not a lasting impression on the whole on the season as a whole or on the viewers. I thought she was a ton of fun to watch throughout. And I'm going to be disappointed that not only do I not have a horse in this race, but I like kind of her little subtle trollings and everything. I think she would have been good for the season.
I mean... She wasn't really there for 4 episodes, and then she popped up in this one and was kind of fun, and then she's gone. I think people overstate how much she contributed to the season, but yeah, she seems fine.
I think she had a lot of potential that went untapped.
Okay, sure. I think that storyline between her and Jeff Kent had a lot of room. There was a lot of room there for something great to develop had they both been in the game for long enough.
Well, we're also forgetting that if she blows up his spot, she might not get her motorcycle at the end.
This is also true.
Or her pink gun. Now, a couple other things we want to touch on. I was listening to Rob Has a Podcast with Boston Rob, and he was talking about how voting out Denise there is a no-brainer, which is a big, big shocker, considering I think 2 weeks ago I said, Boston Rob votes Denise out week one, book it. Very happy to get that validated. What are your thoughts on that? If you're Jeff Kent in this situation, what's your thought process when Denise becomes part of your tribe? Let's hit on this more now.
I'm not surprised that Boston Rob is saying that, because Boston Rob is the kind of guy who's always going to be running things on his tribe. Either he's running things or he's gone. Like, there's no situation where he's playing from behind at any point. So if he's in control of his tribe, he wants to get rid of the variable that he can't control, and that's the person who's only been on his tribe for a number of hours when everyone else has been on his tribe for 2 weeks. So I'm not at all surprised to hear Boston Rob say that. For someone like Jeff Kent, though, where his degree of control is less certain, I can completely understand and endorse, actually, keeping Denise around for as long as possible. It's kind of risky because now the girls of the tribe know that there's a clear dividing line there. So let's say you vote out Dawson, now Katie's a lot more likely to flip come emerge. Whereas if you vote out Denise, you can play it off as if it's just trying to maintain tribe unity or whatever. But realistically, I think having Denise there is a greater benefit to them than having Katie or Dawson or whoever it is. There's also something you have to consider, which is if Malcolm's there at the merge, if he survives on the other tribe, now it's 50-50 because either Denise might be inclined to jump over to Malcolm if he's able to make an appeal to her, but similarly, if Malcolm's on the outs on his tribe, then Denise can drag him over, whereas that might be more difficult if you're just trying to do it without that link, without that hookup there. So, yeah, there are a lot of things to consider there. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I think if you snap vote Denise out there, you send the message to Malcolm that you are not wanted at any point over on with the red team. And yeah, I think that is a message you can't send.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously you end up kicking yourself if you take them both through a merge and Denise ends up flipping on you, but that might be a risk you have to take, especially since if you're Calibur now after Dana's gone, you know that you're probably coming to the merge down numbers, so you need whatever opportunity you can to flip someone from that other tribe over, and if that's Malcolm, then so be it.
I think Jeff Kent did that exact same math. He said, we're going to need some people to come over from there if Malcolm's going to be over there winning challenges for them. I want him to be one of them to kind of give me some protection. Malcolm and Denise, I want them to be I think Jeff Kent put in a lot of work getting Denise real solid with him. I'm hoping he did at least. I think he's a strong enough player to have thought this way and done this. And I think that could be, you know, maybe Caliban not going to continue getting Galood. We could easily see Malcolm flip over if the numbers are close to a point where they could make it happen.
Maybe. The only thing I didn't like about Jeff Kent's appeal was when he told Denise that she's a fourth, which, I mean, she knows that, but there's no reason to make it so explicit. Although I guess you could say that it creates the impression that Jeff Kent is the kind of guy who tells it like it is, so she's more inclined to believe the honest, but I don't know. We're basing that judgment off of 5 or 10 seconds of a conversation which probably lasted for a lot longer than that, which is part of a larger effort, but I don't know. It's something which kind of sends up a red flag for me.
Yeah, and again, this is perhaps me focusing on exact verbiage too much. I think there's a big difference between saying, you're fourth, and so you make four, as in we are collectively four, versus you are fourth out of four.
Okay, but what, do you remember exactly what Jeff said?
I don't. And he may have not said anything even. But I think he said it in such a way that did not give Denise the exact impression, you're the bottom of this group, you're joining on with the three of us that are solid. He said, I think it was more, you make four, and four is most of seven. I think that was more the message he was sending.
Sure, yeah. I liked when they went for Carter's input on this, and he said, well, at the moment, we're fairly alone, as if alone is something which isn't binary. It's like, there are gradations of alone. It's like, Carter, either you're alone or you're not. This isn't difficult to figure out here.
Yeah, actually, I didn't call you on it earlier. Another thing that's binary, uniqueness. Any true Sorkin fan would know this. Uniqueness is binary. Something cannot be very unique, Dom. All right, I have more questions before we get out of here. So my winner pick is gone. I don't even know if you made a winner pick. We didn't do a draft this year. We all got lost. We had so many guests on. Dom, who is your money going forward on?
I want to put RC, but everything we're seeing from the episodes dissuades me from doing that. Like, I think it'd be more natural to put, like, Pete or whatever, but I'm not going to put Pete, because, I mean, it's Pete. Like, I think, like you said, it's hard to not have Malcolm and Denise at the top there. Like, in some ways, it's hard to see how they get to the end, but yeah, in another sense, their path there is very obvious, but it's just a lot harder to execute.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more difficult for someone like Pete to navigate his way to the end and win, even though superficially his method of doing so is a lot simpler. Like, okay, get rid of all the Caliball people, then get rid of Malcolm and Denise and go to the finals with Abby Maria and Artis and lock up the million. But I think that's going to be maybe hard for him to do than it would be for someone like Malcolm to just lay low for a bit, coast until he can flip the game on his head and then just hope to bang off a few challenges at the end.
For me, I'm not sure how many people are now on this list. I think Malcolm and Denise could both win. I think RC could win. I don't think, honestly, anyone else on and Tandang has been our favorites the whole time. I really don't know that anyone else on Tandang can win. Do you disagree?
A few weeks ago we would have said Scoopin', but both Game Logic and Editing Logic are strongly hinting that that's not the case anymore. Game-wise, I would have said that he's well-liked enough that if he can gain control of Tandang and go into the merge with the majority, then he's the favorite to win. But I'm not sure that he is actually that well-liked, within his own tribe at least, because Pete doesn't like him, Artis doesn't like him. I think Lisa's okay with him, but she's just, like, she realizes that it's not really in her best interest to go with him at the moment. And I don't think Abby likes him that much either. So that's three votes that are probably guaranteed to be against him if he's on the jury.
That's possible. I think we could easily see something where, say Tandang does go in with numbers and gets a couple Kalaba out, including Penner, and then Scoopin ends up later becoming just kind of a quiet boot. We could be sitting here, you know, as much as we said about Russell Swann earlier, saying he played the biggest overall role in this season of the returning players.
Maybe.
His lack of success was a much bigger thing than anything either of the other two did.
Well, let's get into Scoopin's edit a bit more, because it seems there are a lot of different outcomes that this total invisibility could be hinting at. The first one, I think, is that he quits, which I don't think is feasible given just how long he's waited to come back into the game. Like, he quits or he gets medevaced or something, but if he were to get medevaced, I think his edit would be a lot more high-profile and over-the-top positive.
Much like it was last time he got medevaced, yeah.
Yeah, so there would be no reason not to give him that treatment. So I think that's out of the question. The other thing I could see is that maybe he's dragged to the end as a goat and he becomes our token third-place finisher who doesn't get consideration from the jury.
I hadn't considered that. That's totally possible. Before I forget it, I want to add, I have other winner candidates. They wear red buffs, and it's pretty wild for me to say that now.
Yeah, but let's say it even for a bit. So,
sure.
Hypothetically, let's say Tandang go into the merge with the majority. They knock off all the Calabar people. Then they get rid of Lisa because everyone loves Lisa. You can't take her to the end. And then it's Pete, Abby, Maria, and Artis against Scoopin and RC. They vote out RC or something because she's better at challenges, and then Scoopin somehow wins Scoopin wins a final challenge, so they have to vote out someone, but then the jury doesn't want to give it to Scoopin.
That's plausible. But does everyone love Lisa?
I think they do.
Not that that's what I'm nitpicking with that argument with, but that's totally plausible. I had not considered third place just because I always feel like Mike Scoopin's a guy who gets respect. But I could easily see certainly myself not voting for Mike Scoopin and many other people not voting for Mike Scoopin.
Firstly, about Lisa, I think a lot of people on Calibur would be inclined to see her as like the nice motherly type, and I think Penner and Jeff Kent are more likely to get on with someone who's older like her than with someone like Pete, who's just this young, brash kid. And if Pete plays the way that it looks like he's going to play, where he's burning a lot of bridges and just having the scorched earth policy, then I could easily see people voting against him rather than for Lisa.
Okay, yeah.
And these are all hypothetical scenarios, because I don't see someone like Pete. I don't see configurations like Pete, Lisa, and Abby Marie or something ever happening, but this is just entertaining possibilities. So what other outcomes do we see from Mike Scoopin? Like, because one theory I heard, and this was pointed out to me, I can't remember who it was now, they said that his edit might be mirroring Chris's from Vanuatu, where he has this very big first episode and drops off until the merge, at which point he suddenly steps into the limelight again.
As someone who watched Vanuatu in preparation for our relatively recent Chris interview, he had a lot of winner quotes sprinkled into those early episodes.
You think?
I think Chris was a much bigger role player than people are giving him credit for. Yeah. If they actually go back and watch the episodes.
And in any case, Chris at least was there. Like, he had some kind of presence, even if it wasn't a very big one. Scoopin has just been completely absent for the past four episodes. There's no peep from him whatsoever. And it's just difficult to figure out what this could mean, because he doesn't seem like the kind of guy who would get zero votes or piss off the producers in a way which would lead them to punish him like this, even if they would be inclined to do that. But at the same time, like, what other outcome is there?
I have no idea, which is there even something we haven't yet seen, some way a player's game can end? That's just, I don't know.
Well, yes, there is. And so if you think back to all the people who have been idled out of the game, so people like Stacey, Kelly Schaber, Alexis, and a few others, all of them had relatively low-profile edits. So it's possible that the same thing could happen to Scoopin. Like, let's say Calibur assume, understandably, that he's leading the Tandang tribe, and they idle Scoopin out of the game somehow, then that could be the cause of this, maybe.
That's totally possible, and sorry, or perhaps he draws a rock somehow, although I don't see that happening with two swing votes.
No. Because it seems like RC has the most kind of well-developed, fleshed-out edit on their tribe, and it's easy to imagine her as a winner pick at this point, but it's hard to see how she makes it there.
That's the other thing for me is I think I have five names now where I feel like I know what a winner edit looks like, and people that are not these five names don't have it, and they're running out of time quickly to catch up to these people. Like, I think, do you agree with me that Pete and Ave Maria, despite being visible, are both out of it for winners?
I think if Pete were to win, this is the way that he would be edited. Like, there's no other way you can edit Pete. He's not some great sympathetic character. He's not overly positive. He's just this guy who, he is who he is. But I don't see Pete being able to maneuver himself to a win. I just don't see that happening.
I think if Pete were able to, he would be more like Todd and would get more like a Todd edit. I think you could easily make Pete more like Todd than he's currently being made.
Sure. Also, as I remember, we didn't see much of Pete in the premiere either, which is a knock against him.
Yeah, he just had that one line about, granted it was a memorable line about, well, we'll see what happens when we get fire. We'll see with Scoopin' hurting himself.
Right. Yeah. He had another great line in this episode where he said, like, you're trying to make the fire, and then Scoopin' puts his hands in it and messes everything up.
Yeah, I noticed that.
It's hard to tell with Pete whether he's actually, like, intentionally trolling people or if he just talks like that naturally. Like, I'm not sure if that kind of comedy is within his range.
I think he's always, I don't think it's intentional. I think he always talks like that. Like, in his pregame interviews and stuff, he just kind of seems to keep sentences going for, like, unlike me, who keeps sentences going for about 60 words too long, he keeps them going for about 4 or 5 words too long. Just one little sub-clause at the end.
Sure.
It shouldn't have been there, yeah.
Yeah, so the upshot of all of this is that we're looking at Cannibal People now for some of our winner picks. Mm-hmm. And so I think Jeff Kent is a surprising one that's at the top there. What do you make of his edit so far?
I am, every single week, I come on this podcast and I say, I like Jeff Kent more.
Yes.
I'm really, really, really impressed with Jeff Kent so far.
Definitely. Do you think he's been edited as a winner, though? Because he had this reputation coming into the season, and it's very easy to just make him the defining star of the entire 14-episode stretch. And, yeah, he's been in the episodes, but not too much. Like, he's just been one more character.
Yeah, no, I feel like I feel like Jeff Kent is kind of like Boston Rob, not as a Survivor player. Well, kind of as a Survivor player, in the sense that if he is to win... this would be what we would kind of see. I could see this being basically his winner edit. And compared to if he were to end up going out poorly, I think they could do a lot more with him that we have not even begun to see. For that reason, I am loving Jeff Kent's chances. I think he is one of two people on Calibre. I think he and Penner could both still easily take this thing down.
I think one point in Jeff Kent's favor is that he doesn't have a particularly dynamic personality when it comes to narrating things. So he's not the kind of guy who you can place in that role and just have him give his input on absolutely everything.
Yeah.
So,
I agree. Yeah. This is what we're seeing of him, given that he can't do that, right?
Yeah. So it's not like there's a lot of wasted potential there that would lead you to think that maybe he doesn't win. Like, this is on course for a winner's edit for Jeff Kent, I think.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Do we have more to say? Actually, are you concerned about the size of the target on Jeff Kent that he's making himself with all these challenge performances?
Do you think people are taking particular note of his challenge performances?
I feel like it's a lot of him doing all the work for Calibre.
Yeah, but again, like, if Calibre come into the merge with a majority, that's not going to matter. And if they don't, then I don't think it's relevant how well he does. He's going to be a target pretty quickly anyway. So
yeah, I guess it's not going to matter much either way, I guess.
Yeah. As for Penner, I don't know. Because his first few episodes were consumed entirely by his hunt for the idol. And then since then, it seemed like he's always just been, there's been no coherent storyline running through his content. It's always been, well, something happens, and now here's Penner responding to it. There's no thread running throughout all of that.
Yeah, this is more of and I know he's a returning player, a third time, no less, returning player, where he's going to get some screen time no matter what he does. I think you're right that it's all been about that idol. I think that idol's going to come into play in a big way, whether it's him, like, a giant episode where he either sits on it or sits on it wrongly or plays it rightly or wrongly. I think we're going to get a big episode out of that idol. And I think it's just process of elimination. I just can't limit myself to only having RC, Malcolm Denise, and Jeff Kent as my winner candidates right now. I feel like I've got to have someone else in there, and I think Penner stands out among the rest by a mile.
So do we agree then that it's Malcolm and Denise by themselves above everyone else, and then below that it's RC, Jeff Kent, and then maybe Penner?
I would say Jeff Kent above RC.
Okay, I can go with that, actually.
Yeah. But yeah, that's my list right now.
And all of Malcolm and Denise, I think Malcolm edges out Denise slightly.
I think Denise might edge out Malcolm slightly just because of the really? Physical. I think Malcolm is clearly the physical presence there.
Just talking about editing logic, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because it seems like whenever something happens to Matt Singh's a tribe, it's Malcolm that gets the majority of the input on that. Like, this totally, episode, yeah. It was him talking about how, well, they need to find the idol so they can go into the into a potential swap or whatever, and then, I mean, Denise had a token confession about that, but it wasn't anything very substantial.
Yeah, although we are seeing, just, I don't know that, I think if Malcolm were to win, we've seen enough from Denise where it's, oh, the jury's going to love Denise. We've seen, you know, that was one of the big hitting points in the Russell Swan episode where he got booted, that I feel like we have all the reason to believe that Denise could still beat Malcolm. So I could see that going. I think it's Malcolm by a nose, and then Denise is the top two by quite a wide margin, then Jeff Kent, and then RC for me, and then Penner.
Sure. So returning to the game quickly, I think we can infer from the previews that there isn't going to be a merge next episode, which would hint that it's going to be at Final 10. So coming into the season, we thought there would be a merge at Final 12 with three tribes still intact, and now we learn it's going to be what used to be the standard, which is a merge at 10 with two tribes. Now, how do you think that changes things, if it does?
Well, I mean, it's disappointing on one level, because I liked the idea of 12 players, so getting at least two people from every tribe to the merge for sure, which I think we're still going to see. I don't think Malcolm or Denise is going anywhere before the merge. But I would have liked to see it at 12, I guess, just to give more room to play. At 10, I think the lines are going to be a lot more forcing and a lot more drawn in this. Like, there are going to be clearer definitions between alliances and slightly less room to play, but I still think there's going to be a ton to play. I think whether it's 6-2-2, 5-3-2, or whatever, any combinations, I think Malcolm and Denise are both surely going to be there. I think Pete and Ad-Marie are both going to surely be there, and I think Jeff, Kent, and Penner are both going to surely be there. And with that group, I'm very excited going ahead.
Okay, well, I too was initially disappointed about this, but on further reflection, I think it might actually work out better, because if they were to merge at 12, which would be next episode, then there would be no time for those cracks within the alliance structures in each tribe to really develop fully yet. So, like on Tandang, they wouldn't have had to go to tribal yet, so they would have an incentive to stick together, at least in the short term. Similarly on Calibur, I mean, sure, the guys plus Casey, I guess, voted out Dawson, but like, let's say they had to go again and voted out whoever, then yeah, whichever one of them is left there at the bottom has an incentive to try and mix things up a bit. This way, though, let's say Tandang goes to Tribal Council next episode and Pete and Ad-Marie and that crowd votes out RC. Now, Scoobin's at the bottom, aware of his position, and if they merge the next episode, he's in a good position to flip now. Like, he has a reason to do that, and that creates some dramatic tension there, even above the question of what Malcolm and Denise are going to do. I think this adds another element to it, which could be quite interesting.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you're only going to get that from the tribe that just lost Dawson if you do it now. And I certainly agree. That's a very valid point, that give these wounds some time to breathe and really drive the knife in there.
Yeah. Also, I think we agree that no matter when they merge, if Malcolm and Denise are still there, then they're going to be the big players in that initial vote. The problem, though, is that you'd expect one of them to stick with their tribe and then entice the other one to jump over. Now, if they had merged, if Matt Singh had stayed intact and they had just been absorbed into one big tribe at the merge, then I think they'd have a lot more freedom to do that. This way, though, like, let's say Malcolm convinces Denise to flip over. Now, Denise, having been on Calibur, when she does that, that's going to be seen as her betraying her new tribe. Like, and that's three or four jury votes that potentially are going to be up for grabs now, whereas she probably had them locked in before. And similarly with Malcolm. Like, if he's going to be less excited about flipping if he thinks that in doing so he's going to piss off like the four or five people who voted out other people in their own tribe to take him onto the merge on the grounds that they thought he was going to stick with them.
That's exactly right, and that's why Boston Rob votes Denise out week one, or in Jeff Kent's spot. Do you think that's they'll consider that betraying? Because I certainly do.
Yeah, although I think if someone like Denise is able to make it to the end after doing that, then she can make the case that, well, I had to play this game for myself, and if you decide to keep me around, then that's great, but that was your own decision. It's not like we were on a tribe together since day one, and we all put our trust in each other, and then I ended up breaking that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think Denise, you know, like her handshake, I think all five fingers were there with Denise for between Denise and Jeff Kent. I really feel like Jeff Kent would take that as betrayal.
Yeah, I do too.
Especially after he's voting out people that he wasn't on great terms with, but he can justify to in his own, as long as a juror can say to themselves, oh, well, this person did something that I could have done, like, if I had done something differently, this person couldn't have screwed me and I would have won. If a juror can convince themselves of that, that one person is going to have a hard time getting their vote.
Yeah, definitely. So I think we agree that if Cannibal go to Triumph again, then Katie's gone, yes?
Oh, I believe so, yeah.
Okay. So the more interesting question is, if Chandan goes to Tribal, what happens?
Well, let's see. It's not going to be Malcolm. It's not going to be Pete. It's not going to be Ave Maria.
Well,
it could be... I don't think it's going to be Ave Maria.
I think this is an open question, actually. Because, like, what do you think Malcolm should be doing here?
Going with Pete and Ave Maria.
Why?
Because I think they are people who are going to make themselves targets throughout the entire course of the game. They're not going to be the smartest people to have to deal with. And I'm presuming that Emerge is coming at 10.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like cut out their other options, make them feel like I'm good with them, hopefully swing Denise over and play an end game with these clowns.
Okay. Yeah, I think the deciding factor for me is that if you team up with Scoop and Narcity and Dragon, Lisa, and Red Up, let's say Pete, then Abby Maria is not the type of rational player who you can convince to stick with you in the short term. Like, she might just flip out and want to run to the other tribe as soon as she can, and similarly with Pete. Whereas, if you do it the other way around, I think you can make the case to someone like RC that, okay, I can understand why you feel you're at the bottom for now, but that's not going to be a permanent thing. Let's vet out some of the other tribe first, and then we can switch things up a bit later. And she's going to be willing to go along with that. And similarly, like, if Pete is sincere about his desire to take Malcolm far in the game with him, which he said in his secret scene that he was, so there's no reason to doubt that, then that's great for Malcolm, because I think he easily beats Pete and Ave Maria, and I assume Artis as well. So once he gets into an endgame with those people, then assuming he can have the boot order he wants, then he can be sure of locking out the million.
Yeah, totally. No, I'm loving... This is, again, why we've been saying for a long time, just being able to look forward weeks in advance is why we've been so in love despite Matsing losing all these challenges with Denise and Malcolm's positions, because the natural result of the way these games are going to play out when these other tribes haven't been to Tribal Council before getting these new players is these new players are going to be the difference makers and they're going to be the decision makers.
Yeah, definitely. So I think that's all we have to cover this week, unless you want to add anything else.
No, I'm all out of stuff. So thank you guys, everyone who listened. Find us on iTunes again, subscribe there. Anything else before we get out of here, Dom?
No, that's it for me.
All right, cool. So thanks again, and we will talk to you guys next week. Take care, everybody.